History comes alive with the thoughts and experiences of Connecticut's men and women who participated in World War I more than a century ago. You will hear, in their own words, about the impact of World War I on their lives and also on their families' lives. There is much to learn from the extensive World War I records and documents collected by the Connecticut State Library. During the war, then State Librarian George Goddard collected countless war-related items to ensure that future generations would have a true account of Connecticut's role in World War I, for the benefit of, as he stated, our children and their children. A Hartford Current article published in 1919, following the conclusion of World War I, stated that Connecticut State Library led the nation in preserving the information concerning the sons who went forth to do their part in making the world safe for democracy. A selection of these war records and documents is now accessible in audio versions with human narration for all students and adults, particularly those who are unable to read due to blindness or other print challenges, including learning, physical, intellectual, or emotional disabilities. Funding, in part, for this project comes from the National Historic Publications and Records Commission, also referred to as the National Archives. All Voices of World War I recordings, along with digital versions of the documents recorded, are available on demand at no cost on Chris Radio's website, chrisradio.org.
Many of Connecticut's servicemen and women received their war training at Camp Yale in New Haven, on the grounds near the Yale Bowl in New Haven, in the summer of 1917, according to an article, quote, "The 102nd Regiment at the Western Front," published in Connecticut Explored magazine. It was at this camp where the soldiers met a bull terrier mutt named Stubby for his short tail. He became the regiment's unofficial mascot and was smuggled onto a military ship by the soldiers when they were shipped overseas. While on the front line in France in 1918, Stubby became very useful, running among the soldiers and barking when he found a wounded soldier. A New York Times article noted that the popular wartime dog once caught a German spy. Stubby was eventually promoted to Sergeant Stubby and earned medals for bravery, including a Purple Heart Award. While Stubby was among the most famous at Camp Yale, numerous men, including countless immigrants, also trained at the camp. One such immigrant was Raymond J. Queenan, who suffered injuries while serving in the war. In his war record questionnaire, Queenan wrote,
"I was anxious to go. I wanted to see what war was like, and did. I would have been ashamed to have been drafted. I saw the need and didn't believe in waiting for a personal invitation. I feel that my experience overseas broadened me physically, mentally, and morally. It made me dependent on myself. I found that I could do the right thing when I only had myself to answer to. I was scared stiff, but I was afraid to show it. I saw so many killed that I lost all fear of death. My only fear was the thought of how the folks at home would receive notice of my death. This was my last war, absolutely. There were too many this time who stayed home and, quote, made money while the boys fought, unquote. The old saying slightly twisted."
Harry Smith Campbell, resident of Niantic, Connecticut, who emigrated from Scotland, participated in several major battles during World War I. He also shared his thoughts about the war in his war record questionnaire.
"It has created in me a sense of resentment towards conditions which necessitate peoples to resort to violence to settle disputes which they had confidently left to their representatives to handle. There was neither honor nor glory in butchering someone you didn't know and couldn't hate. It has given me a greater love for humanity and has even taught me to sympathize with my enemies. That might, without right, has neither known glory or flag."
Connecticut women also played an important and brave role in World War I, serving on the front lines in medical units. One such woman was Ruth Hovey, a nurse from Hartford, who served in a surgical unit during the heavy fighting. She was 27 years old when she joined the Army's Medical Corps. In a letter to her mother on July 18, 1918, she wrote,
We went to bed as usual Sunday night about 11 o'clock with our gas masks and tin hats by our sides, and at midnight exactly, we were awakened by a shell whizzing over our hut and landing in the tomato patch behind us. And at the same time, the gas alert was sounded. With one accord, we grabbed for our gas mask and hat, then hell, it seemed, was let loose. Never have I heard such a noise in my life. The other girls put their blankets on the floor and huddled together. I got into my clothes as quickly as I could, and it's a good thing I did, for I was the only one that was dressed, and Mary and I were the only ones that did not get back to the hut again. The big steel dugout I wrote you about saved the day. We were taken there at once and stayed until the wounded began to arrive, and then the operating staff left the dugout and got to work. We operated all night under shell fire until about 5 a.m., when the shells began to drop into the hospital. Before Mary and I left the operating room, a shell whizzed by and took a piece off the roof over our heads. Our sleeping quarters and two of the wards and the men's huts were wrecked. Two patients were killed in bed and others wounded, and through it all, Mother, everybody stuck to their posts, and nobody lost their heads for a moment.
Ms. Hovey was later awarded the Croix de Guerre with Bronze Star for her heroism. After the war, she married a 28-year-old medical officer who she served with during the war.
Some servicemen wrote about their war experiences in a diary. Charles F. Watrous enlisted in the National Guard in New Haven and saw combat in 1918. He wrote about the conditions and danger in France during World War I.
December 28th. The fellows all went to the trenches today and it was snowing like the devil. The roads are full of snow and it's very hard traveling. They got back at about 4 o'clock Saturday morning, December 29th, and it was an awful trip. The trenches were full of snow and it's been terribly cold. Some of the boys have frozen feet and can't walk.
2 months later, on February 13th, he wrote,
went out to dig trenches with the bunch, and it was sure rotten digging. It was kind of misty, so the Boche sent us a few presents, but they didn't reach us, so we kept on. All's okay. Anybody could get lost very easily at night out here in the battlefield of Malmaisine. I guess that if I fell down once, I did 50 times coming back. You couldn't see 3 feet ahead of you, and you would slip into a shell hole on one side, and then you would go down on the other side. It was sure hell without any mistake. About one half of the company got lost coming back.
Those who remained in Connecticut also played an important role in World War I. Residents were reminded about the American principle, that is, every man in this planet has just as much right as yourself to the road. In the government-issued pamphlet entitled, For Native-Born American Women, What You Can Do, women were advised to be friendly to their immigrant neighbors.
Be neighborly with immigrant families. Take at least one immigrant family and be a friend and neighbor and an interpreter of America to it. Make every national holiday Americanization Day by asking immigrants to your homes. Give up a part of each day getting acquainted with your immigrant neighbors. Teach the language to a class of alien women, getting your introduction from the schools, settlements, or Americanization workers. Discourage in your children the use of immigrant nicknames. See that the sanitary condition of the stores, houses, streets, and vacant lots in the immigrant sections receive equal attention from the authorities. Get together. America is a weak nation so long as class and racial lines prevail. Help alien women in industry to make right adjustments and see that they receive such protection as they need.
Food and resources were scarce not only overseas, but also here in Connecticut during World War I. The Connecticut Agricultural College Extension Service also published emergency food series suggestions. One such publication advised residents on, quote, cutting the meat bills with milk.
Emergency food series number 2. These furnish the same amount of food measured by actual nourishment. 1 quart of milk at 15 cents. 3/4 pound round steak at 25 cents, 8 eggs at 26 cents, milk, a cheap food. Therefore, it would be economical to substitute milk sometimes for meat or eggs and reduce the cost without reducing the amount of food. Milk is not the cheapest of all foods, but it is cheaper than meat or eggs. Combined with cereal or bread, it is cheaper than milk alone. Cereal alone is cheaper still, but not so inviting. It is true economy to combine milk with cheaper foods and substitute it occasionally in place of more expensive foods.
Newspapers during those times also depicted a patriotic culture where Connecticut residents rallied behind the war effort. These articles also describe a very different culture compared with Connecticut's culture today. Consider the call for factories not to employ teenaged girls in the February 21, 1918 Thompsonville press article entitled, "Keep Them Out of Factories. Men Workers Are Not Exhausted."
Miss Margaret Slattery of Boston, known from coast to coast as a lecturer on girlhood, Sunday night denounced factory managers who seek to have girls take the places of men in their plants. The address, entitled American Youth and Democracy, was delivered at a meeting of the Ford Hall Forum. "You businessmen of America, keep your hands off American girlhood," she cried. "If there is a real shortage of man labor, call upon women over 25. They can do the work with less danger to prospective citizens of New America than can girls in their teens." She also spoke of the danger to girls that lurks in the streets of every great city. She said that in New York, it was found that lists of missing persons included more names of girls in their teens than of any other class. "In the recent draft, thousands of our boys were rejected as physically unfit. Why? Because the mothers of these boys were forced to work over machines when they were in their teens. Employers are putting girls to work running elevators and doing men's work in stores. They say they are unable to get men to do the work. In many cases, the fact is they employ girls because they can pay them cheaper wages than they can men."
Connecticut was swept up in patriotism. An article published on August 1, 1918, in the New Haven Evening Register described a segregated unit of World War I draftees in the article entitled, "98 Colored Men Given a Big Send-Off."
Draftees depart in cheers and songs during a remarkable demonstration. Mayor speaks words of praise to them in reception. That predominating characteristic, cheerfulness, was demonstrated in this city as never before when 98 men, New Haven's first quota of color citizens, were sent away with a smile on the 1021 train from Union Station for Camp Devens, where they will go into training to take up the fight in the cause of liberty and democracy. It can be truly said that the boys were sent off with a smile, for from the time they left the center of the city, from the various draft boards and marched down Meadow Street to the station, they were a happy crowd of draftees, and the strains of the popular war songs blaring forth from the instruments of the State Guard band, which together with a platoon of police led the procession. Cheer upon cheer greeted them. Meadow Street, from one end to the other, was lined with friends, relatives, and admirers of New Haven's first large quota of colored draftees. And at Union Station, there was a huge outpouring of people. A special squad of police detailed to properly direct the traffic there reported later that the crowd was one of the most orderly, considering its large number that has never been handled there. At the track entrance at Union Station, the crowd was separated from the draftees, who were escorted across the tracks to the third platform by draft board officials and the band. Wives, mothers, and sweethearts and close friends were allowed to pass the gates for a last farewell to their dear ones, so soon to don the khaki in their country's defense. A crowd of at least 3,000 people soon congregated at the station, and at 10:15, the draft special with four carloads of colored boys from Bridgeport and towns in that section came into the station, colors flying from every window. A huge shout went up from the assembled people. Three additional cars were coupled onto the special, and meanwhile the draftees gathered in a large group and sang thrilling patriotic airs, while mothers, wives, and sweethearts choked back the tears. Even some attempted to give vent to their emotions through the expression of jig dancing. Attorney George W. Crawford, as master of ceremonies, together with Edward Biggs, assistant clerk at the probate court, and the draft board officials were on the job with handshakes and cheering remarks to the departing men. Just prior to the departure of the train of draftees, the second section of the 1021 train came into the station. Professor Taft, who has been in Washington for the last few months, was one of the first to alight. A huge cheer from hundreds of the throng arose to greet him, and bowing and smiling to the men, he watched the train start out on its journey to Camp Devens. It is with reluctance that the women in the crowd allowed the train to go, and many ran alongside of the cars, nearly the whole length of the platform, in order that they might hold his hand until the very last possible second.
The impact of World War I on Connecticut was profound on the state as a whole, the men and women who served on the war front, and those who remained at home. To hear more stories from the Connecticut State Library's World War I archives and articles published in Connecticut Explored, visit Chris Radio's website at chrisradio.org and click Voices of World War I.